I figure if I can be semi-successful in U.S., competing with many of my peers as a minority, right, being a Hong Kong-born Chinese, I thought as Hong Kong and China opens up, I could be a bridge for Western capital looking to access opportunities in China and beyond and Asia, and vice versa, eventually helping Asian capital accessing U.S. market.
Welcome to the Distribution by Juniper Square, where I sit down with industry leaders across private markets. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff. On today's episode, I sit down with Goodwin Gaw, chairman and co-founder of Gaw Capital Partners, a real estate private equity fund manager with about $35 billion of assets under management focused on Asia Pacific and other high barrier to entry markets across Asia, the United States, and Europe. On today's episode, we discuss Goodwin's journey into real estate, the dynamics of cross-border capital flows, especially between Asia and the United States, and Gaw Capital's unique approach to de-risking new markets and investment opportunities for their investors. I always enjoy my conversations with Goodwin, and I know you will too. Let's get into it. Goodwin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brandon.
For our guests that don't have the pleasure of knowing you, can you briefly introduce yourself and your organization?
Yes, Goodwin Gaw. Chairman, CEO of Gaw Capital, co-founder. We are real estate private equity fund manager, 15 offices, 10 countries, and focus on all various different asset classes, depending on the cycle of the various markets that we play. About 35 to 36 billion gross asset on the one hand.
Excellent. Well, we had the pleasure of getting to know each other many years ago when I lived in Hong Kong. But before we talk about your company, Gaw Capital, and the markets you invest in, curious to understand, you know, you've had a very prolific career as a real estate investor, but how'd you get into the business? Kind of talk to me a little bit about, you know, where you grew up and how your upbringing kind of helped inform your journey into commercial real estate.
Thank you, Brandon. Well, I grew up in Hong Kong, so kind of it's a mixture of East and West, bicultural city, a little bit like New York on steroid, right, on the water in Hong Kong. And I went to high school, boarding school in the U.S., in New Jersey, in fact, boarding school in New Jersey. And then went to Penn undergrad and then did Stanford grad school, civil engineering, actually, not business school. Undergrad was finance at Wharton and civil engineering also. So as they say, right, enough to be dangerous when we deal with a contractor, knowing how to build a building, but more knowing how to build bridges and tunnels. So that's really the background. And I would say deal number one was probably quite pivotal. Well, two pivotal things. One, I got a job working for Kennedy Wilson, a company, investment bank in Los Angeles. This was mid-90s, right when a lot of the Japanese or Asian investor was selling off out of the last savings and loan crisis, LTC days, right? So in the mid-90s, at the late part of that cycle, learning how many of the Asian investors with trophy real estate in the U.S. were selling off for cents on the dollar. So that was the right timing to get in. Worked there, learned from Bill McMorrow, my mentor, for about 2 years there, and then came across my first deal. It's called the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel. It was quite an unusual situation. This is a hotel that was down on its knee in Hollywood. At that time, Hollywood is really by name only. You got prostitution, you got homeless, you got drugs, you got everything. But this hotel happened to be, the ballroom happened to host Academy Awards number one. Back in 1928, original investors were Douglas Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, and the likes of them. Pretty interesting. Chapter 11, owned by a Japanese syndicator. So I came across it, 335 rooms, 3 acres of land across from the Man Chinese Theater. Was able to actually buy it out of court for $9.5 million. Convinced an equally younger banker, Dominic Ng of East West Bank, to essentially give me a $6 million loan to put the asset deal together. My family is in business, so I was fortunate to be able to at least pitch the idea to my father. I said, I found a bankrupt deal, $30,000 a key, 3 acres of land, Hollywood, I can revive it. So basically the answer was, you're 27, you have no idea what you're doing, it's bankrupt for a reason, no. And then ended up, he gave me a terms. The terms were, raise $3 million from an outside investor, I'll consider lending you $1 million. But I want 50% ownership. For the $3 million that you raise, you can only give away 50% ownership. So those were his deal terms. And there were no promote and no fees. So I lived and breathed it for about 3 years, took the hotel from Chapter 11 to almost $3 million in EBITDA within 3.5 years. Refinanced the asset, $6 million became a $12 million debt. $5 million went to buy out my $3 million investor and then pay my father back his $1 million on 12% interest during that period of time. And that was deal number one. We still own that asset today. And from that deal number one, I started targeting a lot of these downtowns across the US, San Francisco, LA, New York. At that time, not too dissimilar to today, honestly. Everyone was shunning all these downtowns despite all the infrastructure was happening in all these downtowns. So I started kicking up empty buildings in downtown LA, quite distressed office buildings in downtown New York, downtown San Francisco. And those were the initial basis of downtown properties, as the company was then called. And a bunch of the buildings in downtown LA, eventually, I found a usage for it. They became data centers. But this was 97, 98, the very, very early days of internet. And so the data centers were actually platform exchanges. But those were, I was fortunate to be able to buy these empty buildings around a building called One Wilshire, which is the central hub of where the submarine cables from the Pacific landed into Santa Barbara, hit downtown LA, cross connect traffic, go to Denver, and hit East Coast. And so those early buildings that were empty, parked for maybe $20 to $40 a square foot, were housing telecommunication equipment at about $30 square foot rent. So those were pretty eye-popping returns because of this initial usage. So that gave me a good start. And then as it evolved, I started doing different asset class, buying up empty office buildings, historic office buildings that have a lot of soul, but they were empty. They were basically homes to dead pigeons and rats, essentially. So those actually, those buildings, we eventually turned into a housing hub in the historical core of downtown LA. So I look for these opportunities where assets that have an interesting history or assets that have a soul or assets that you can reinvent and then figure out how to capitalize it. As we get more and more active, I was able to start tapping into capital from Mesref, from Angelo Gordon as the business evolved. So learn how to be an institutional fiduciary that eventually led to the formation of Gar Capital when China and Asia opened up in 2002, 2003. I figure if I can be semi-successful in US, competing with many of my peers as a minority, right, being a Hong Kong-born Chinese, I thought as Hong Kong and China opened up, I could be a bridge for Western capital looking to access opportunities in China and beyond and Asia, and vice versa, eventually helping Asian capital accessing US market. That's where we had our roots. So between 1995 to 2003, I did about 70 plus transactions. Some deals were quick buy, fix and flip. Some deals were just put in the contract, double flipped it just to build up capital. What else? I would say there was one transaction that probably helped me save a lot of capital or build up capital to launch our business in Asia. It's a building called 60 Broad Street. So that's a 1 million square foot office tower on the corner of Broad and Beaver. And then I, maybe for my engineering roots and always a product focused person, I always like to build things. So this was an empty building, 1 million square foot, former home to Drexel Burnham Lambert, former home to Kidder Peabody. So in Chinese, we say that's probably not a good karma building, feng shui wise, because those are two famous companies that went bankrupt, right, in the building. But since I'm just an investor, I don't intend to go occupy it. It shouldn't affect us. So that was when Olympia in New York actually defaulted on that particular deal. And the collateral was owned by a Hong Kong tycoon called Li Ka-shing, K.S. Lee. He took the building back, did want a building that's full of asbestos and 100% vacant. So we're able to buy that actually in 1998 for about $60 million for 60 bucks a square foot. And then how we repopulate the building, I thought the building has a very large base, typical of these Emery Roth design building in downtown New York. But it sits on two corners with eight elevator beds. So we essentially divided the bottom of the tower, these 50,000 square foot massive floor plates. We glued it two of the eight elevator banks, but gave them an entrance on Beaver Street. So the lower part became offices to government agencies, Department of Social Services, and actually the legal department of New York State. And I remember there were a bunch of judges during the tour. I flew to New York to tour them myself, show them all the private bathrooms inside all the Drexel former executive offices. So judges, if you're doing an ATI, you couldn't actually build private bathrooms in your own chambers. But because this was recycled TI, I think that sold them. So they went into the lower part of the building. That gave us a very large lobby off Broad Street, a block and a half from Wall Street, right? Stock Exchange in New York. Four top towers with 360 views to the Statue of Liberty and the Hudson River. So that's how the building in about 2.5 years got, went from zero to almost 100% occupancy. And then I sold it, made quite a bit of money on that trade, and then used that seed capital to sack off capital.
What a story. There's so many parallels to where we are today and some of the different markets. Before we talk more about the market fundamentals today and kind of what GA is doing right now, you grew up in Hong Kong, but why boarding school? I mean, it probably wasn't your decision, but why boarding school in the US?
It was seen, right? Hong Kong is a melting pot of East and West. And very early on, it has always been very Westernized. In those days, a lot of my peers, a lot of my friends were going to boarding school in the UK. But US is always seen as the future, right? Europe is a little bit of the past, as US is always seen a little bit of as a future. So boarding school in the US offer sort of a way to acclimatize to the culture, the US culture of being creative, being open-minded, allowing you to essentially discover who you are and what you want to do and where you want to go. It's a good, as they call it, it's called prep school, right? So it's a good stepping stone to eventually a US education, which we believe in Asia is the best in the world. And it still is the best in the world, right? I have two 22-year-old boys. They're both graduating from US universities.
Did you think that when you came to the US for prep school, you would stay for university and then go back to Hong Kong? Or did you think you would stay and maybe live and put down some more permanent roots in the US?
I think that was to be decided, honestly, right? It all depends on, in a way, I was kind of clueless, right? Going to college, trying to figure out what I want to do. I kind of know I want to be in real estate. I kind of know I want to build buildings, but I didn't know whether I wanted to become an architect or whether I want to be a financier or a developer. So the opportunities kind of find you. You can navigate, you kind of have to figure out your passion. I think I do a fair bit of guest lecture in university. People ask me, what's the secret? I said, there's really no secret. Real estate is not that complicated, right? We're not writing codes, we're not programmers, we're not inventing something out of thin air. It's more, I always say, you got to be a little lucky to get an opportunity. And then you got to be maybe above average smart to know that if the opportunity knocks on the door, you better go try to capture it. And then you got to have the perseverance, right, to really see it through, because you're going to be banging your head against the door multiple times. And when you're young, people think that sounds like a good opportunity, but you're too young. It's probably not the right deal because you just don't have the experience. But obviously, I think luck finds you. Right? Today, it's interesting. I do town halls with my global office all the time. My guys, this is back to 1995, 1996 in many of these cities. I never thought I would see it again. And here we are, 30 years later.
Interesting. Before we go there, so civil engineering. And then did you go straight to grad school to study? No, you were undergraduate finance, graduate civil engineering. Did I get that right?
I was undergraduate in a double degree program at Penn called management and technology. So a civil engineering and finance.
Civil engineering and finance. Okay. And then was it right after undergrad that you went into Kennedy Wilson, or did you go straight to grad school?
No, it was about an 18-month gap. I actually went to Atlanta to work for a golf course housing developer. At that time, UPS, I remember vividly, UPS decided to move the headquarters to Atlanta. So that was the early part of Atlanta being a boom town. Of course, it's booming again today for different reasons. But back then, Atlanta was booming because of UPS and Coca-Cola. And so I like golf. I thought it would be interesting to go on a golf course community to see how homes are built and how it's done. So it was kind of an internship that turned into a little bit of about a year of a work experience.
Interesting. And then when you came out of graduate school, did you mentioned Kennedy Wilson, and they're a great firm and it's obviously still around today. Did you already have that internship lined up, or how did you get connected to Kennedy Wilson to kind of get your start in real estate, which ultimately led you to your first deal?
I started, that's an interesting one. I thought when I was actually there in grad school at Stanford, you know, there's always a rivalry between Stanford and Los Angeles. Right? You go to SoCal, you drive on La Brea, you see strip malls after strip malls after strip malls. San Francisco is beautiful, 280, 101, beautiful trees, beautiful forest, beautiful country, right? So I always thought, okay, never would I be in SoCal. And then as I navigate whether I want to settle down in San Francisco, LA, and where the opportunities are, LA keeps calling. Essentially, met friends, introduced me to various players in the real estate industries. And I thought, huh, LA is actually less old money, much more welcoming to new ideas, new immigrants, new person. As long as they do something right, people don't seem to care where you're from and why you're here. So in a way, it seemed easier than San Francisco, which is more old money focus, right? They look at your pedigree, they look at where you're from, why are you here, and all of that, you get a question. So and it just seemed more natural in terms of opportunities. And then got to meet Bill, Kennedy Wilson. So that was a good mentorship for me.
Amazing. So I didn't realize that the business started. So before Gaw Capital existed, your U.S. entity was called, or is still called, Downtown Properties, right? And that preceded Gaw Capital that we all know today.
Correct. That started deal number one, Roosevelt, in 1995. So that was quite active, right? About, as I mentioned earlier, about 70 transactions, plus or minus, in the U.S. between 1995. Yeah.
And so you mentioned 2002, 2003. This is, you know, post the handover of Hong Kong, you mentioned Asia starting to open up. What was happening? Like, what do you mean Asia was opening up? And where specifically did you see the opportunities for cross-border capital, both from Asia coming into the U.S. market where you could facilitate, but also for our U.S. investors starting to get curious or interested in more allocation to Asia?
Well, I think those are true where China and U.S. started a very strong symbiotic relationship, right, between China trying to take a big part of its population out of poverty by becoming the factory floor to the world. When in U.S., we're looking for a manufacturing partner at a much lower cost basis than U.S., so that U.S. can focus on intellectual property rights, focus on creating the best products for the world, but having a manufacturing partner to manufacture those goods at the cheapest price possible for worldwide consumption. Right? That was actually really the beginning of their symbiotic relationship that ultimately led about 800 million people out of poverty into middle class in China, and indirectly allow U.S. to actually not have inflation for a very, very long time, right? Because goods manufactured from China based on U.S. IP and U.S. design keeps getting cheaper and cheaper by the year. So when that symbiotic relationship happened, as it accelerated, by 2002, 2003, it was very clear that there is a huge middle class and a lot of consumption power in China, which will translate into increase in real estate value, whether it's buying more residential real estate to storage as a storage of value for the wealthier household in China, or consuming more Western-style goods. Right? American brands, whether it's Starbucks to Procter & Gamble, anything that's American brand in China was seen as a premium product. So when you have that happening, as the consumption class start growing, you're no longer just a manufacturing floor. So the wealth was no longer just concentrated in the factory owners, but in more of the masses. So that made sense for capital to want to invest into a high growth economy. Now, at that time, China was nowhere near the number two economy in the world, right? So those early days, from my point of view, I felt being a Chinese, having to gain some success in the U.S. as a minority, and knowing in particular how the mindset of institutional investor in the U.S. works, having partnered with Mesref and Angelo Gordon and the likes, I thought I could be a good translator. Right? They would see me, the U.S. investor would see me as a Chinese face, helping them navigate China. But in China, they will see me as a foreigner because of my culture, starting the business in the U.S. and learning and growing up in the U.S. educational system. So that kind of middle ground, being a bridge, was quite useful in those early days.
So let's talk about kind of the investment in China, because you've been investing there for a long time. You had this generational shift in wealth that happened to start things off. But what did those first few deals look like? I mean, what were the most investable assets for U.S. investors as they just dipped their toe in the water with your help? Like, what were people looking for, U.S. institutional investors?
I think everything in China, in terms of number of people that walks by the building, to retail sales in a city, to foot traffic on a certain street, all of that is mixture zero, right? So early days was pretty simple. Let's look at urban core, prime plant asset that has a lot of footfall, has a lot of, but then you can potentially convert the footfall to dollars, right? Let's look at that. And so many of these assets, you have to understand, in China was basically a socialist economy for a very long time. Capitalism, market-based economy was just the beginning. It wasn't entirely beginning, but was still it was third inning out of a ninth inning ballgame. And so you see a lot of assets that were owned by state-owned enterprises, not understanding how to maximize the value. So we were actually out there buying historical buildings on high street retail, office buildings that we actually, some were torn, we would tear down and rebuild into a new high rise, or a lot of times it's retrofit assets. And some of these interesting assets, yes, you're looking at it, you say it's impossible to buy because some of these are tied to long-term leases on 20, 30 years. So you got to understand the system and be creative. I still remember a deal in particular where we bought a building, we could only buy 80% ownership of it, 20%. It's tied to a set of enterprises. You're thinking, okay, you pay them equivalent of 30 years of rent, they will leave. But they won't, because it's a state-owned enterprise. It's a bookstore. They have about 200 employees that are under pension. You give them that money as a buyout, they don't know what to do with the money. So basically, it became cheaper because we knew how to navigate. We basically went to them and said, we will give you a 30-year back-to-back lease. So we lease the operation from you, we pay you your entire year's profit every year ahead of time. You can then keep your employees around and they don't have to do anything. So stuff like that, right? So it takes someone with enough local knowledge, but also enough understanding on how foreign investor think in terms of the investment to tie the two sides together to do some of these early deals. And they were quite successful.
So at what point did you know that this idea, did you ever doubt that this idea had legs? I mean, did you always know that there was an opportunity and you could go build an entire organization specifically to facilitate this cross-border exchange of capital into real estate?
I think the idea came from in about 2002, 2003, when I moved back to Hong Kong, thinking this would work. My first couple of deals were joint venture with Mesrush. And in fact, Keith Barquette and Angelo Gordon, who I got in very close, the late Keith Barquette, I think many in the industry knows, right? Essentially the founder of Angelo Gordon real estate strategy back then. So Owen Thomas, I think he was on the show before, OT, Sonny Kelsey, Jay Mounts, a few of them I got very close with. So Mesrush were my early partners. I think we were the partner for them in some of the first couple of deals they've ever done. Mesrush has already done in Hong Kong. And those were good seed assets. It happens to be in the period where SARS, right, the earlier version of COVID essentially happened in 2002, 2003. So that actually created a window opportunity where assets were artificially distressed. So some of those are really good buys, resulting in 4, 5, 6 times multiple on chunky money. And I think also gave me the confidence to say, Western capital really will come to Hong Kong and go beyond Hong Kong to go to China. They just need a God and they just need a father.
So what does Gaw Capital look like today? Maybe give us the size of the organization, you know, the markets that you're invested in, kind of the geographic footprint, employees, et cetera. Help us understand what Gaw Capital looks like today.
Today, about 500 employees split in 15 offices, about 9 to 10 countries. So we have product-specific funds like Southern Europe Hotel Fund to Pan-Asia Data Center Fund, to China Data Center Fund, to Vietnam-specific strategy, to Japan-specific strategy. So it's really, I would say, as we evolve, it's really about what, how do we find the intersection between where we see the opportunities and also what our significant partners want. But in a way, sometimes they'll tell us, I'm really missing this particular asset class. And then either we feel we are the right partner for them to help them deploy their capital for that asset class, or we'll go to them and say, we like the strategy. They may or may not like it. Then it may or may not fit, right? So we're trying to find that fit. Ultimately, I think the larger sovereign wealth fund institutional investors are getting smarter and smarter as they move up the knowledge curve, even in these emerging Asia economies. So they are going from just purely giving you capital to deploy blindly to saying we actually want to morph or evolve the strategy in a way that allow us to allocate the portfolio more appropriately.
So in that latter context, that sounds more of like a separate account or, you know, more of a JV partnership. Maybe kind of what are the different vehicle structures or types? Are you managing closed-end funds, open-end vehicles? You do separate accounts, it sounds like, kind of anything across the capital stack?
Now, I think we're right now investing our Gateway Fund 7. It's a Pan-Asia strategy that we raised between the main fund and co-invest about $3 billion of capital about 2 years ago. So we have been deploying that Fund 7 in the last 18 months. Along that, we also have separate accounts that are somewhat tied to the main fund, where we would tailor-made strategies for some of our larger LPs, where they say they specifically want more exposure to this country that's covered by the main fund, or they want more of that asset class, or they may want more core plus versus opportunistic, or core plus versus value-add. So we're tailor-made for them, and then they would actually, those essentially would act as discretionary co-invest vehicle.
And because you're in so many different markets across the region, actually, it sounds like around the world, how do you think about entering a new market and building up the expertise, right? I mean, you gave some examples of, you know, how you navigated one of the deals in China, where it was very specific to, you know, the entity and the local customs and norms of what was expected of the counterparty. I'm guessing the same thing is true in other gateway cities. I'm guessing it's true in Vietnam. So as you get the mandate or you get the conviction for a best idea, sometimes you're starting de novo, right? Maybe not. You're going into a new country. How do you think about that process of getting comfortable with a new country, a new market, new rules and regulations to bring your investors in there?
So I built a business starting up being an entrepreneur, finding these opportunities or unloved asset, or finding strategies that I feel we can be a contrarian to the consensus. So if we're going to an entirely new market, I would say we actually would be going in, investing our own capital as an entrepreneur to get a feel, to prove our thesis, to see whether our hunch is correct. This is whether going into Vietnam about 7 years ago when a lot of our investors were rushing for the exit, or certain sector or data center in China where the early numbers are not great, but then the cloud and also the large language model deployment is actually behind the curve. So you can actually go in and pick things up really, really inexpensive these days because the big four are not deploying capital as the Western counterpart yet, right? As an example. So we tried to go in and invest our own capital to test the thesis. And then generally, then we actually would want to find a local partner, right? Someone that we feel could be an entrepreneur in his own right, could be someone that can start his own firm, but then wouldn't know how to raise the money. And essentially try to bring, either do a JV with them or eventually bring them into the fold as our head partner for their country. Our motto always is, how do we be the best in class as an institutional fiduciary by being transparent, by being very prudent on risk management, and also by having very transparent reports to our LPs so that we are an institutional class fiduciary, but be very entrepreneurial in how we execute deals. Find deals, do it, and execute the strategy.
As a entrepreneurial and entrepreneurial and contrarian investor, when you look across, whether it's Southern Europe, whether it's Asia, the US, kind of what are a few of the pockets of opportunity that you're most excited about where everybody else is kind of running for the exits, like you said?
Well, I think something the US is most interesting, right? US got hit, COVID recovery, and then got hit by work from home. And then it got hit by everyone running for the exit because they think office is no longer useful going forward because AI would eventually replace the people who are working from home. Multiple reasons hitting certain asset class particularly hard. And then certain cities are being written off altogether, right? Whether it's downtown LA, I would say it may not come back in a long time. But then you look at downtown San Francisco, it made no sense to be so low, to be so distressed, or Seattle for that matter, right? These are not very big downtowns. So I do feel US in particular always have a system that's quick to reset. And when it's a system that's quick to reset, the values do drop very, very quickly. Because when there's a reset mechanism, sometimes no one knows where the floor is, when there's no liquidity and when there's no transaction. In those window of time, if you actually have the liquidity to double down, it could more than make up for any mistakes you all have to harbor. And obviously, we're not immune to the problems when your funding costs went up by 3x, when everyone is running for the exit, trying to sell assets when there's no taker. There's no way to really know what the floor is. But at the same time, that actually presents the best opportunity because banks are penalized for taking ownership of these assets in the US in particular. And banking systems do not work the same way in Europe or in Asia. Hence, the opportunities and the reset mechanism is not there to create these opportunities, at least in such a short time frame.
So you talked about a few different markets. Are there specific offices a sector? Are there other sectors that you're particularly bullish on right now?
Yes, I do like, obviously, everyone is chasing data center. And that's an interesting asset class. I know it fairly well because we were active in that space in the mid-90s before they were even called data centers. But again, right, that's a lot of capital chasing that sector. It's really hot right now. There are really only a few big users as the hyperscalers. And then once, even if you're lucky enough to create the right project to sign a 20-year lease with them, the exit number is so big that I'm curious where the taker on these, where the exit is going to be for some of these very large assets. So even though that's an interesting opportunity, it's not easiest to play, and it's not easiest for us. If you're an infrastructure fund player, maybe you can play it because you do have very long-term capital and you can ultimately securitize an income stream over a very long period of time without having to sell the asset, essentially. But if you're an opportunity fund looking to create value for investors in a 5 to 7 year timeframe, I think you have to look for this location. So obviously, office is an easy one to pick through because it's being brushed with such a big brush as being essentially uninvestable in some of these coastal cities. Hospitality is another one, right? We see many of these cities, San Francisco in particular, conventions are way, way down. People are going, everything is moving to Vegas. But eventually, the price delta of hosting a very expensive conference in Vegas would eventually maybe bring some of these conferences back to where these companies are based, in Oakland, in San Francisco, in Seattle. So you have to look in the next 3 years and look at, as things normalize, interest rate will be dropped a little bit, at least past the peak cycle, financing become available, what are some of the asset class that will correct relatively quickly or go through a paradigm shift?
It's interesting. And you own office buildings in the US today, right?
We do. We do. We managed to sell a fair bit in the last 5 years, but we still have some. Yes. And we actually have been buying back into the sector, in particular in San Francisco, in the last 6 months.
I don't want to rabbit hole on it, but like, what is your take on San Francisco? You mentioned that you think that the floor is, you know, too low relative to the size of the market and the opportunity. But what do you think is going to drive the change that we're all expecting to see in San Francisco?
I think by and large, right, if you walk San Francisco today, it has such negative news, as it should. You go a year ago, anyone can walk into a store and take stuff out. As long as under $1,000, you won't be prosecuted, right? So homeless on the street corner everywhere. No longer in that 2-block radius, became 4 blocks, 6 blocks, 10 blocks. So all of that visually looks very, very bad and scary. So it's all true. But then you go back 6 months ago, and then you go back 3 months ago, and you go back a month ago. Every time you go back, it has been changing cleaner. And that simple optics is actually starting to attract young people back into the city. You see the bars getting populated again. You see the restaurants getting populated again. So you know these are not people living in the suburbs coming in to get entertained. They actually are moving back into the apartments. And you start to see apartment rents starting to firm up and go up again. Occupancy is actually quite high now, again in San Francisco. So when you see all that, then you realize employment is actually starting to come back, or at least more and more of the larger employers are forcing employees back to the office from 3 days a week to 4 days a week to many cases 5 days a week, with some flexibility on that one extra day, on the fifth day, where they are. Right, so when you see those changes, and then when you overlap that with Anthropic, OpenAI, these are all the large language model platform. Both of those companies are headquarters in downtown San Francisco for a reason. If you're building a large language model, you're going to be needing a lot of companies that build inference layer companies onto your platform to help monetize what you have built and feed your revenue. And so that means a lot of collaboration with new startups, companies needing 3,000, 5,000 square foot space. So I don't think that's a natural setup in a walkout in Silicon Valley versus a more open community like pockets of San Francisco.
Yeah, interesting. I was we're recording this in September of 2014. I was in San Francisco yesterday, and I agree with everything that you said. I go up, you know, once a month or more. And it was about as clean as I've ever seen it. The streets were about as crowded as I've ever seen it. We hosted a cocktails at a bar downtown, and it was busy as I had ever seen it. Not just our event, but just around us. There was just a buzz. People were out and about, and it was a very refreshing scene. So I hope you're right, and I hope it's the sign of a turnaround.
I hope we're right too.
Yeah. Let's talk, to keep the positive energy flowing, let's talk about China. You know, obviously you have a lot of history investing and doing business there. And I think, suffice to say, China's economic situation has been challenged as of late, as has ours in the United States. I'm curious to get your take on kind of the situation right now in China, and, you know, kind of what you're seeing, if anything, from investor appetite. Do some investors see this as a great contrarian play right now, or is it pencils down on China for foreign investors in particular?
I think in particular for U.S. investors, U.S. institutional investors, or large U.S. GPs, China is difficult. It's hard to understand. It's a political system that is very, very vastly different than U.S., and it's going through a lot of structural changes, right? Let's leave aside the geopolitics of the conflict between the number one economy and the number two economy. History tells us there's always a conflict. But even if we put that aside, China has a large domestic consumption market. That should solve a lot of problems. But that's actually very weak right now. And it's weak because the government is probably not wrong in wanting to correct the real estate bubble that was bubbling up. Too much debt in the real estate developers, getting too much product, the market can't absorb, potentially causing banks to have a lot of bad loans on their balance sheet. But they may have been too heavy-handed in the correction. That caused essentially even relatively healthy developers to get in big trouble with a lot of unfinished units. So when, and China, one thing is peculiar in China, you have to understand, Chinese people prefer, or they feel safer with their savings in bricks than their savings as cash in the banks. As a result, a wealthier household will tend to own one flat for their own use, another flat for the first kid when they get married to help them buy the first flat. In fact, there was always this term called naked marriage, where if you are a young couple, you're getting married and the husband doesn't have a house in his name, that's an unstable and naked marriage. That's an embarrassment for the families for that, right? So if you understand that, you realize how much money is parked in real estate from every household savings. And that's your balance sheet, right? So a household balance sheet, China, I think, is over 90% home ownership. And about two-thirds of that house of balance sheet is actually in real estate, whether it's one house, a two house, a three house. That's what they say. All of a sudden, if you just take an average, say 30% correction in home prices across the country, 30% times 70%, that's roughly 21% impairment in your balance sheet. So all of a sudden, you're not going to feel very secure in your retirement when you have that impairment. And so if you look at the last few years, the savings rate of Chinese household of income versus savings, the ratio has gone way up because people are not confident in their home balance sheet. They're not confident about tomorrow, so they're not spending. If Chinese consumers are not spending and China export is under pressure with tariff in the fight with US, you're going to be making for a very subdued economy. And until that confidence come back, it's going to be a pretty difficult place to deploy a large amount of capital. And I think the fact that so many of the foreign players are out of the market, it's also a market that even if you want to be a contrarian, you don't need to do it so early because it's unlike US, there's not a whole pile of dry powder sitting on the sideline waiting for that moment of pivot for them to jump back in. China, many of the players have left the market. So in a way, for those who actually still have boots on the ground, I think we can afford to wait.
And when you look across other markets in the region, I think you're in Vietnam. Which other markets are you in Asia?
We are in Singapore. We are in Australia. We are in Korea quite actively. And of course, we're in Japan. Japan is probably the largest market for us outside of China, right? China, if you include Hong Kong and China, Japan is second to that. If you include China without Hong Kong, then Japan is actually larger than China already.
And Japan's been a very popular market recently, especially for foreign capital entering, but also the demographics are, you know, challenged as well, or impaired, if you will, from a population growth perspective. But what is the kind of opportunity that you see in Japan from a real estate perspective?
I do think twofold. I think a bad thing about Japan is somewhat of a consensus trade. I mean, if you have capital to deploy in Asian real estate, Japan is the only large market outside of Hong Kong. And Hong Kong is also going through a funk right now. Japan would be the only one where you can deploy a large amount of capital and have liquidity to exit. That's a good side. And the bad side is obviously the consensus trade. But then the good side is it's such a large market that you are buying from a lot of very large real estate owner in Japan who has held on these assets for a very long time. They tend not to be optimized on the cost structure if you're buying a hotel, or on the revenue structure if you're buying just an office building, because they tend to value these long-term cross-holding companies' relationship so they don't charge each other market rent or they don't focus on the cost structure. So if they actually find the right opportunity, and in some cases, do conversions to create new product that the market doesn't exist, right? We did a joint venture with another firm, Bento Green Oak, where we took a Class D asset, actually almost Class C asset, in a great location. Any Japanese developer would have knocked the building down and rebuilt. We looked at it as we don't gain square footage, and there's more value eventually for someone to assemble a bigger site before they knock it down. In the meantime, we were able to buy the assets pretty cheap because a lot of Japanese developers didn't know how to deal with a Class D, Class C asset in such without knocking it down. We looked at it and we say, this is a product perfectly similar to what we have done on assets in Shoreditch of London or in the Mission District of San Francisco, where we take an older Class D, Class C box that's very Art Deco-ish and then brought in a hospitality-centric designer to make the office asset hospitality-like, and make it vintage. Then all of a sudden, you return that building, take what's deemed to be a disadvantage or a negative aspect and turn it on its head and make it positive. You actually renovated the building to make it even look older, but more authentic, more vintage. And then that building attracted a lot of media, music, telecom, and tech tenants, and paid premium rent for an asset that's more vintage.
More vintage. I like that. More vintage. That might be a new asset class, the more vintage asset class. I like
and
it.
And more authentic. Yes. I think that's the key.
Which district is that in, or which neighborhood of is it in Tokyo?
Aoyama, yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Fascinating. But before we move off the region, what are you seeing from an outbound capital flow perspective? You know, Asian capital, you know, Asia's a big place, a lot of different countries, a lot of different political structures and motivations. But for a while now, we've seen fairly significant capital coming out of the region into U.S. real estate. As you talk to your network and investors who are domiciled in the region, what are you hearing with respect to their appetite for U.S. real estate? Are they actively investing? Are they holding their capital to keep it at home to, you know, fix any capital stacks that are broken? Kind of what's the sentiment right now?
I think different pockets, right? For a long time in the recent past, the bulk or the big volume of the capital has been from China, whether it's state-owned developer and privately owned developer looking to diversify and spread their wings. Those have been curtailed and cut back because China essentially, one, has cut those developers down essentially by reducing the leverage to make sure they are healthier. And in many cases, the wings have been clipped. And then partly also, they want to control the fund flows between China and US. And so many of those even stronger real estate companies are encouraged not to invest overseas, but to focus on fixing the domestic problems and finishing all the unfinished projects in China, which as they should. So that large capital flow is gone, and it's going to be gone for the foreseeable future. Now, for a while, you actually have quite a bit of Korean capital also going to US, but those were very active right before COVID, through COVID. So I think many of those capital still has to work through their problems in US, because in Asia, Asian capital is not used to the non-recourse system where many US sponsors can just hand back the keys and walk away, right? So this is a bit of a new cultural phenomenon for many of these even institutional Asian investors to deal with. And so you're definitely seeing that curtail off significantly due to the problems being worked out and worked through in the US system. The Japanese were never that active in the US. And these days, with the very weak yen against the US dollars, it does make it even harder, even if they want to flex their wing and go outside. I will say, with the exception, right? Singaporeans, GIC in particular, is very, very active and very sophisticated. They know how to invest in various cycles of the US. They understand it very well. And as a result, you are seeing them being quite active, very selective in pretty interesting distress situation. They're one of the very large and most active.
Yeah, and GIC is very well known in the alternative space for being large and very active around the world. So,
and smart, right?
Yeah. And very smart, very sophisticated, exactly. So as we kind of look forward, you know, what are you, you know, you've been through many cycles, you know, you referenced SARS as kind of the earlier version of COVID. We're kind of coming out of this COVID period here in the US and other parts of the world. You see some contrarian opportunities that maybe others aren't as focused on. But when you look at the next 12 to 24 months for Gawk Capital, where are you going to be spending most of your time and, you know, on behalf of your clients, not the entrepreneurial side of the business, but the fiduciary client side of the business?
I do think we are known as more of a Pan-Asia manager. Of course, we invest around the world. I still think US is most interesting as a fiduciary for some of our high net worth family office clients from Asia. They do like the contrarian thing in US. So US, I think we will be helping more of the Asian family, high net worth family office navigating finding opportunities because the mindset is similar to how we are in investing, right? So I think US distress, it's definitely most interesting. And then in Asia, I think Japan and Korea will be a large market for us, right after that, followed by Australia. In the last 2 years, we have been focused on deploying that capital into private credit in Asia in particular. But a lot of those capitals are being recycled through as the capital come back and get fund seven, we're starting to look for more interesting opportunity, in particular Japan, Korea, followed by Australia.
Is private credit in the Asian real estate context, does it function in a similar way that we think of private credit here in the US, or are there any kind of nuances that, you know, we need to be aware of?
Very, very good question. Brandon, very different. And it's very specific country to country. But private credit, it's all tied to the legal system, the foreclosure process, how quickly and or how complicated does it is it to get your hands on the asset, right? Even though sometimes you may not actually enforce the asset or take the asset, but the ease of getting to the asset allows you to have a much stronger voice when things don't work out. Obviously, Hong Kong, it's the greatest system, very, very easy. Since hence, and also distressed large developer from China would ask us in Hong Kong, needing liquidity, and with many of the larger US players out of the market for quite some time, until recently, some of the private credit focused players are back in the market, in Hong Kong in particular. But China is very difficult to enforce. Right? The reason why you see such a mess in the bond market in particular is many of the bond investors, when they buy the bonds of these Chinese developers, they thought they have collateral of these developers' assets in China. But the China wall doesn't recognize these bonds have no actual lien on the assets inside China. All they get is an IOU from the publicly traded developer in Hong Kong, most often publicly trading, but sometimes private developers. All you're getting is the corporate IOU saying, I'll repay the bond. But when they default, the Chinese banks inside China all have senior claims. Even as a junior lender in China, they all have more senior claims than any senior bonds outside of China. But that's why many of the foreign investors and many retail investors are going to get quite hurt with this whole wave of default by the big Chinese developers. And then you go to Korea, the enforcement mechanism is fine, but also the market is very flush with liquidity from its local banks. So the spreads are not there. So it's really market by market. Singapore is not really quite there because the local banks are flush with liquidity, the economy is healthy, not a whole lot of distress. As a result, you just won't get enough of a spread. Australia is a different market, right? Banks are by and large pretty conservative. Until an asset is cash flowing and stabilized, they tend not to be able to get financing. And sponsors and developers are fairly thinly capitalized. So there are opportunities where you actually can get paid quite well with a good spread being a gap financing partner for well-conceived projects that sells out pretty quickly on the pre-sale stage. So it's really market by market where the opportunities are.
Yeah, I think it's so important as we think about these different markets and we say things like Asia to understand, you know, that it is really a bunch of very distinct markets and very distinct sub-markets in some cases. And I appreciated that from my 7 years that I spent living in the region and trying to develop somewhat of an appreciation for these things. We're almost out of time. I think, you know, I've really enjoyed the conversation. Your journey and kind of entrepreneurial spirit comes through very clear. And I, you know, a lot of people who listen to this podcast are investors and allocators and consultants and very institutional, but some are kind of at a point in their career where they're thinking about, you know, what could I do next? How could I become more entrepreneurial, breakaway? I know you spend a lot of time doing guest lectures at universities. What advice, you know, would you give to somebody who might be hearing this story and feeling inspired? And what lessons have you learned or what advice would you offer to somebody looking to kind of step out there and become a little bit more entrepreneurial?
I think you have to find your own passion, right? Ultimately, the passion comes through. If you have real estate, of course, data is important, right? Understanding, knowing data, studying data so that you're not stepping into a landmine where the market you're going to is completely supply-demand imbalance or the city is going through a downturn that's out of your control. You have to understand enough data to have a correct macro view. But beyond that, real estate is a lot of gut instinct, right? If you're truly passionate about real estate world, you're going to have a certain gut instinct. And you just have to figure out that gut instinct, where does that take you to create a niche strategy where you see something that not everyone sees, or you have more knowledge than someone else in that micro market, in that specific asset class that you feel the broad market is not seeing, whether they're not seeing it because they will see it in 12 months and you'll see it early, or they simply don't see it because they don't understand this neighborhood is tied to a certain specific culture, that culture wants things differently than the other culture, or a specific deal where you have such deep knowledge and the situation is so broken that you have an angle into it. You have to find the angle. That very first deal, it's either your passion, your specific knowledge, or your insights that lead you to create an angle. There's a lot of capital out there these days, right? And the fact that the property prices have reset so much, it is a very interesting opportunity to take that risk, to go and find that first deal, to prove your thesis and create your first track record.
I love that. Well, I think that's a perfect note to end on. I've enjoyed our conversation. We could talk for hours, but alas, we are out of time. So I really appreciate you joining me today, Goodwin. It was great to see you, and thanks for your insights.
Thank you, Brandon.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter @B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.